This is strongly reminiscent of Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi, who also did not give initiation and upadesha, as usually understood. And yet, when asked by a devotee whether it was necessary to seek elsewhere, replied that it was not. The extreme importance of this question becomes clear when one remembers that in Hinduism and esoteric Islam, as in other religions, it is held that spiritual attainment during the life on earth is possible, except in the rarest of cases, only through initiation and upadesha by one who has himself attained. It can be regarded as the transmission of a current or at birth to a spiritual parent. To one who has grasped the possibility of spiritual attainment, life holds no other goal. No human purpose can compare with that which transcends the human state. Therefore, the vital importance of recognizing a true guru and being accepted by him. Not every spiritual man even is a qualified, guru, except in the case of a maharshi or originator of a path, the authorization must have been transmitted to him in an unbroken chain from guru to guru, like the ordination of an exoteric priesthood. One who is not a guru may benefit mankind by his mere existence, by the radiation of an influence. There are other possibilities also, but he will certainly not take on himself the responsibility of guiding disciples or detaining them from others who can function as guides. If such a one as Sai Baba or the Maharshi took this responsibility, it means that an invisible type of upadesha was in use, whether the disciples were aware of it or not. And Sai Baba did assert in plain terms his responsibilities for his devotees, his watch over them, and the absolute reliance they could place in him. He said, "I will never allow one of my people to escape from me." And the Maharshi said, "Just as a prey that has fallen into the jaws of a tiger will never be allowed to escape, so he who has won the grace of the Guru will never be abandoned." Sai Baba said, "Only keep quiet and I will do the rest." And the Maharshi said the very same words, only using the impersonal Bhagavan instead of I. Sai Baba said, "Wherever you may be, think of me and I am with you." Again, there was the same assurance, though in slightly different words, that Sai Baba did exert a tremendously powerful influence over his devotees, there is no doubt at all. Many have testified to the awakening and fostering of spiritual life in them. Certainly also he strove for them. He practiced the laying on hands. Baba had a way of touching the head of a devotee who went to him. His touch conveyed certain impulses, forces, ideas. Sometimes he pressed his hand heavily on the head as though crushing out some of the lower impulses of the devotee. Sometimes he tapped the head or made a pass over it with his hand. Each such action had its own effect, causing a remarkable change in the sensation or feelings of the devotee. Sai Baba was in fact training his devotees to seek God through devotion to the Guru. It will be remembered from the account given in the first chapter of this book that this was the method he himself had followed, and it was this that he enjoined on his followers. That this was his upadesha can be seen also from his exposition of a verse on the Bhagavad Gita quoted in chapter 1, where he said that complete surrender of body, mind, and soul, and possessions was the necessary means of attaining realization. It is epitomized by Professor Narke. Quote, obeying, serving, and loving God are the chief features of Bhakti Marga. The peculiar feature stressed by Sai Baba's example and words is the vast importance of developing this devotion on the basis of devotion to one's guru. It is seeing God in, through, and as a guru, identifying the guru with God. This is a legitimate and traditionally recognized method. Here again, it recalls the Maharshi who said, God, guru, and self are not really different. They are the same. However, he added a safeguard by explaining that the outer guru serves only to awaken the inner guru in the heart of the devotee. And it will be seen that the inner guru is the same as the Christian conception of the Christ in you. Sai Baba explained less, but there is a record of his also stressing the inner guru when he said, in apparent contradiction of his own teaching, it is not necessary to have a guru. Everything is within us. What you sow, you reap. What you give, you get. The actual meaning is the relative unimportance of the outer guru once the inner guru can be recognized and heard. He continued still more explicitly, it is all within you. Try to listen inwardly and follow the direction you get. It is important to note, however, that he did not say this to everyone. It is a very dangerous practice until the devotee is sufficiently purified and developed to follow the inner guru, because all manner of selfish promptings can slip into a stream of consciousness and advertise themselves as inner spiritual direction. That is why normally the outer guru remains necessary. Normally, Sai Baba's teachings, this is the life of Sai Baba, you know, Shirdi Sai Baba, mm-hmm. written by Arthur Osborne, who was a disciple of Bhagavan.
Oh, okay.
And wrote extensively on Bhagavan. Mm-hmm. So he wrote this book of Sai Baba after Bhagavan had passed away. He's British.
Oh, okay. Bhagavan was alive when he wrote this book, you said?
No, he wrote it in the 50s, after Bhagavan's Mahanarada.
Okay.
But the author is British.
Mm.
He lived at Reminition.
He did.
His sister is still there. His daughter, one of his daughters are still there.
Well, I'm really happy to be introduced to Sai Baba because I've never really got it. My parents worship Sai Baba, but the Afro one.
Oh, yeah, this is different.
Right,
yeah.
So I never followed for whatever reason. In my heart, I was never...
Yeah, this is a different one. Normally, Sai Baba's teaching was simply devotion to the guru and complete surrender to him. A very potent method, but one which can be safely used only by the perfect guru from whom all trace of ego has been burnt out. Otherwise, a frightful danger. Sai Baba theorized little about it because, in general, he theorized little. The following story illustrates it well enough. A devotee was staying in the house of Ayi, a woman devotee permanently resident at Shirdi, to whom Sai Baba often sent visitors. He said, we agreed that japa, invocation, was the best course for us. The important question was what name we should use for it. She said that many used the name such as Vittal or Ram. But so far as she was concerned, Saya was her god, and that name was enough for her. I said that what was good for her was good for me too, and that I also would take the name of Saya. So we sat facing each other and repeating the name together for about an hour. Later in the day, Saya Baba sent for me and asked me what I had been doing that morning. Japa, I replied. Of what name? He asked. Of my God. Who is your God? He asked next. I simply replied, you know. And he smiled and said, that's right. Thus, Japa of his name was expressly approved by him. And perhaps silently instigated by him through the meditation of Ayi. It seems equally significant in this story that the invocation of his name was approved by Sai Baba and that it was approved secretly, not publicly. His position was already anomalous through the ritualistic worship performed by the Hindus and condemned by the Muslims. But a no less important distinction was between those Hindus who were following a spiritual path through devotion to God manifested as a guru, and those more numerous who simply accepted the spiritual and material benefits that accrued from the presence of the saint. This type of sadhana or spiritual path through utter reliance on the guru has been well summarized by Professor Narke. Quote, according to the tradition of Sai Baba, the disciple or devotee who comes to the feet of a guru in complete surrender has, no doubt, to be pure, chaste, and upright. But he does not need to continue any active practice of japa or meditation. On the contrary, any such practice or any intellectual process which involves the postulate, I am doing this, is a handicap. All sense of ahamkara, ego, in the devotee has to be wiped out, swept out of the memory of the mind, as it is an obstruction to the guru's task. The guru does not teach. He radiates influence. This influence is poured in and is absorbed with full benefit by the soul, which has completely surrendered itself, blotting out the self, but it is obstructed by mental activity, by reliance on one's own exertions, and by every kind of self-consciousness and self-assertion. This great truth must have been grasped by all observant visitors to Sai Baba. He himself sometimes said to devotees, stay with me and keep quiet. I will do the rest. That is secretly and inwardly. So the duty of a devotee or aspirant is firstly to keep himself chaste, pure, simple, and upright, so as to be fit to receive the Guru's grace. And secondly, to have full faith in the beloved Master to raise him to various higher and higher experiences, till at last he is taken to the distant goal, whatever that may be. One step enough for me is the right attitude for him now. He need not trouble to decide upon complicated metaphysical and philosophical problems about ultimate destiny. He is as yet ill prepared to solve them. The Guru will lift him up, endow him with higher powers, vaster knowledge, and increasing realization of truth. And the end is safe in the Guru's hands. All this was not uttered by Sai Baba at one breath, either to me or within my hearing, but the various hints I got from his dealings with people and his occasional words about it add up to this, and common sense points the same way. This is an excellent synopsis of the Upadesha of Sai Baba, and it is perhaps natural that his devotees should give it a universal air as though it applied in all cases. It does not, of course. Meditation does not necessarily involve the postulate, I am doing this. In particular, the inquiry, who am I, taught by the Maharshi, does not. It inquires, who is doing this? Also, no complicated metaphysical or philosophical problems are involved in envisaging the ultimate goal, which is simple Advaita, non-duality, oneness with the Absolute. And the Maharshi, for instance, expected his devotees to envisage this from the outset. Neither is it necessarily true that the Guru endows the devotees with ever higher powers, vaster knowledge, and increasing realization of the truth. The process may take place in darkness up to the final self-realization. Also, it needs to be said that to remain receptive to the Guru's influence and perfect purity and uprightness, to keep quiet so that he can do the rest, is no easy task. In fact, it is the most difficult thing for the mind to do. And the purpose of meditations or invocations may be precisely to attain and maintain this purity and tranquility of mind. Those who are unused to such teaching may be alarmed at the emphasis laid on passivity, regarding it as dangerous or as leading to spiritual emasculation, which means
taking away your masculinity.
Oh, so that's a
spiritual
do with men?
Emasculation.
That's just to do with men.
No. Purushartha. Taking away your strength. Purushartha.
Those who are unused to such teaching may be alarmed at the emphasis laid on passivity, regarding it as dangerous or leading to spiritual emasculation. But it is not. Passivity to evil and to the ego is dangerous. Passivity to the senses and sense impulses leads to a gradual disintegration of character. Passivity to truth and to a spiritual influence leads to integrity and power. That is why one sees that the saint who is of all men the most submitted to the divine will and the most lacking in ego is at the same time the most dominant and outstanding in character, the most individual because he has sacrificed his individuality. Passivity towards God makes a man active or powerful towards the world. Passivity towards the ego makes a man active or rebellious towards God. That is why in the early stages submission is so difficult. Three great and widely known masters in recent times have been Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa, Sai Baba, and Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi. Sri Ramakrishna taught at Bellore outside Calcutta shortly before Sai Baba was established at Shirdi. And when Sai Baba died, disciples were already being drawn to the Maharshi on Arunachala Hill in the south. There could be no better example of the utter difference of temperament and aptitude than these three masters, all of whom were powerful and dominating, and all supremely passive to the divine will. Several times already attention has been drawn to similarities between the path laid down by Sai Baba and the Maharshi. There are similarities with Ramakrishna also, and considering the differences of temperament mentioned above, this can be interpreted only to mean that certain methods are recognized by the masters as suitable to the times in which we live. It is of the utmost importance, therefore, to see what they are. In the first place, all three upheld the equal validity of all religions. In previous ages, when each religion was more or less confined to its own parish, this was a matter of little practical importance. The average Christian had heard nothing of Buddhism, nor the average Buddhist of Christianity. But with the rise of the modern one-world civilization, materialist and rationalists began to point to differences between religions as an argument for regarding them all as erroneous and man-made. And since mankind in general came to know something of the various religions, this was a dangerous argument. Superficial champions of one religion who denounce others were playing into the hands of the destroyers, whose very theme was that each religion claimed a different and conflicting truth. It was for those of real insight to uphold that truth is one, and that only the modes of expression vary. After attaining realization through Hinduism, Ramakrishna followed the path again, first through Islam and then through Christianity, and proclaimed that both of them led back to the same goal. Sai Baba, as we have seen, had trod both the Islamic and the Hindu way and guided disciples on both, compelling each to recognize the validity of the other. Ramana Maharshi was above all religions, as the peak to which they ascend, the center from which they radiate. Among his devotees were Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, Parsis, as well as Hindus, and he never expected any to change from one religion to another. Perhaps the most important consideration is that a path suited to modern times should be invisible, unencumbered by ritual, capable of being followed in the conditions of modern life, in the office or workshop, as well as in the hermitage. There are many sincere aspirants who have to live in business or professional life with no facilities for ritualistic observances. They have to follow their path inconspicuously among their colleagues, conforming to modern social conditions. This has been provided for. One is apt to think of the followers of Ramakrishna as ochre-robed swamis, but it must be remembered that the Ramakrishna mission, to which these swamis belong, was founded after his death. During his lifetime, he often refused permission for a devotee to renounce the world, as for instance in the case of Durga Charan Nag, whose biography the Ramakrishna Mutt at Madras has published, considering him to be a saint. We have seen in the present book how Saya Baba encouraged family life. There were fakirs and sadhus among his followers, but those who were householders, when they first came to him, remained such. The Maharshi also consistently refused requests of his devotees to be allowed to renounce the world and go forth as sadhus. It is not only a question of remaining a householder, but also of simplicity and, in fact, invisibility of the path followed. The method of self-inquiry taught by the Maharshi requires no outer observances, but can be followed inwardly. Sai Baba, as has been shown, prescribed no ritual or incantations. Sri Ramakrishna also taught no elaborate ritual in all three cases. Striving is largely through devotion to the Guru. For most of their devotees, this overshadows everything. Quote, keep still and I will do the rest, unquote. The tremendous power of the gurus is working. All that the disciple has to do is to refrain from obstructing it. Next chapter, Death and Survival. There was a rehearsal of Sai Baba's death as early as 1886. He died in 1918. He said to Mahalsapati, a devotee already referred to who resided permanently at Shirdi and slept beside him in the mosque, I am going to Allah. Take care of this body for 3 days. If I return, I will look after it myself. If not, bury it in that open land over there, and put up two posts to mark the place. His breathing and circulation stopped. His heart stopped beating. The civil authorities held an inquest and pronounced him dead and ordered Mahalasapati to bury or cremate the body. In accordance with the law that a body is not to be kept longer than 24 hours. Mahalasapati, of course, refused. On the third day, breathing again began, and the abdomen was seen to move. Then Sai Baba opened his eyes and returned to life. He was just playing around. He could do anything he wanted.
Yeah, he wants to see if they'll take him serious.
His breathing and circulation stopped. His heart stopped beating. The civil authorities held an inquest. It was after this, in fact, from about 1900, that his fame began to spread widely. From about 1910 till his death in 1918, there were unending streams of visitors from Bombay and other towns. Even now, he's the most famous guru all over the world.
And now he's become really,
serious. They forced pomp and ceremony on him that he did not want. Processions with horses and elephants, a silver chariot, incense, and singing. During the processions, they loaded him with jewelry. They treated him like a maharaja and like the idol of a god. He disliked all this, but they would not be refused. Still, he continued to go out and beg his food. His health gradually weakened. He suffered badly from asthma. The striving for his devotees was strenuous because a guru takes the burden on himself. Even physically, it may be so with the performance of cures. On Vijayadasami Day in 1960, he had an attack of frenzy when he tore off his clothes and went about stark naked for 2 hours, crying out that it was his day of crossing the frontiers. It was on the same day, 2 years later, October 15th, by the Western calendar, that he breathed his last. Before going, he sent some devotees back to Bombay, who had intended to stay, and detained others who were due to leave. He bade farewell to one who used to pay him fortnightly visits and told him not to continue coming. None seemed to have grasped the point of these dispositions. He sent word to another Muslim saint, the light that Allah lit, he is taking away. And the saint received the message with tears. He gave 200 rupees for feeding fakirs, and they sat chanting prayers and reading the Quran. It was the time of the Hindu feast of Dasara, and the Rama Vijaya was read before him. So this was maybe April.
Same time.
This April or?
No, this is the time for Dasara, no? Okay. Navaratri. It starts 20 to Sunday and ends. This is the time.
Mm-hmm. He had been sick for a few days, but those around him did not realize that it was the final sickness. In the morning he was ill. About midday he sat up and gave first 5 rupees and then 4 to the Brahmin, who used to receive a daily 4 rupees for preparing his food, for the food he begged was often uncooked and was cooked later at the mosque. He sent those who were with him out to take their lunch. 2 Brahmins alone remained with him. One of them relates, Baba gave me his last instructions on the day and breathed his last. After sending Dixit away, he gave me some instructions and told me to keep quiet about it, saying that I would die if I revealed it to anyone.
It's like a John Wayne kind of warning.
Then he said, I am going. Carry me to the Wada. That's the mask part of it. Only Brahmins will be near me. With these words, he breathed his last. After these words were spoken, Nana Nomonkar poured water into his mouth, but it came out. I held my hand under his chin to catch the water. Baba expired leaning against me. Sai Baba was here using the word Brahman in its true meaning of spiritually inclined person, as he did. For instance, when he said, this is a Brahmin mosque. By wada, he referred to the building where he was to be buried, a large stone house built by Bapu Sahib Bhuti. Some years previously, Sai Baba had appeared in a dream, both to him and Despande, the same night, desiring him to build it. When Bhuti asked his permission to do so, he not only consented but said, when the temple is built, we will live in it. Once Sai Baba was no longer physically alive at Shirdi, Bhuti had no wish to occupy the newly completed building. So it was used as its destiny had been to house the shrine. Despite Sai Baba's expressed wish, there was disagreement about his burial. The Muslim followers, holding that he was one of them and should be buried by them in a building to be erected for the purpose. The civic authorities therefore circulated two petitions for signature, and as more than double the number petitioned for burial in the wada, this was done. It was agreed by both parties that both the wada and the mosque would be kept open for pilgrims of all religions. The fire which Sai Baba always maintained is still kept burning in the mosque.
Yeah, it is still there. The 2 days is still there.
But railings have now been put around it. This is 1957. I'm sure it's much different now, right?
Yeah. Now it has got a glass pane.
The sacred ash is given out as before to devotees who desire it. Railings have also been put up at the entrance at the east end of the mosque. Sai Baba was fond of smoking tobacco from clay pipes, which quickly broke or got foul, and hundreds of which littered the mosque and its courtyard when he passed away. Many were taken away as relics, and then the remainder were gathered up and cemented into a blot, which is kept in the mosque, together with the water pot and coconut shell jug he used to use. The chawadi, or rest house, where, for a large part of his life, Sai Baba used to sleep every alternate night, was a dismal mud structure like the original mosque. But a large part of it collapsed in 1916, and it was rebuilt in brick. A large portrait of Sai Baba is kept here. It may be asked why Sai Baba's Hindu followers should have buried and not cremated the body. Actually, it is a tradition that the body of a realized man should be buried. He has passed through the fire already. There is no need to do so symbolically after death. There was something delusive about his death and burial because all knew that Sai Baba had not died. He was arranging his survival at the same time as his burial. Some 2 weeks beforehand, when they had no suspicion of that the death was approaching, he ordered R.B. Purandare and H.S. Dixit to leave for Bombay, telling them, I will go on ahead and you can follow me. My tomb will speak. My clay will give you replies. This should have been warning enough. But one must remember that Sai Baba's devotees were accustomed to hearing strange sayings from him. A lady once told Sai Baba that she depended on him utterly for refuge and guidance and would be hopelessly adrift without him, and asked him what she was to do when he passed away. He replied categorically, Wherever and whenever you think of me, I shall be with you. Once again, a parallel arises with Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi. When his death was approaching, some devotees appealed to him in the same way. And he replied tersely, "You attach too much importance to the body." The implication was obviously the same. There was no change in Sai Baba's guidance of devotees, his answering of prayers, and his protection in time of trouble. Indeed, so continuous is his influence that in hearing or reading accounts by his devotees of their experiences, one does not find any dividing line at 1918, the same kind of episodes occurring before and after. And of course, with most of the devotees one meets today, all cases of intervention come from after that date. He appears to them in dreams and visions as before. They turn to him to receive his answers and protection. When decision is difficult, they write out various solutions on slips of paper and, with the paper for guidance, place them beneath his picture and accept the one they draw as his instruction. Invisibly, he guides and influences them. He has said that no devotee of his shall lack for food or shelter, and they have found it so. People turn to him in distress and find relief. And deeper down beneath this gracious help in the storms of life is a spiritual current maturing them to deeper and less tangible rewards. A devotee has recorded how he visited another saint, Narayana Maharaj, in 1927, looking upon him as Sai Baba in a different form, still attached to Sai Baba but craving the consolation of a human presence to see and a human voice to answer him. He said nothing of all this, but the saint told him, "Yours is a supreme guru. He is of a higher rank than me. Why have you come here? Your choice of a guru is excellent. Go to him and you will achieve your purpose." Another tells how his child was sick with pneumonia in 1934 and had, in addition, an open abscess on the chest. The doctor was afraid to operate on the abscess on account of his weakness. It was a wide open wound. The doctor would not help me, so I relied on my own doctor, Sai Baba, and put a little of his udhi, sacred ash, into the wound. The deputy collector, V.R.M. Jadhav, asked me whether I was confident of a cure and within what time the gaping wound would be healed. I answered, "Within 24 hours. That night, Sai Baba appeared to me in a dream and rebuked me, saying, "You should have said immediately." I apologized. I apologized in my dream. And when I woke up the next morning, the wound was healed. Jadhav was so surprised that he asked for some of Sai Baba's udhi for his own four-year-old son, who was down with pneumonia. It was already the sixth day of his fever when I gave him the udhi, and the fever stopped next day, although the doctor had told him it would take another 3 days. The same child who was cured of the abscess had already been saved by Sai Baba when he was two. He fell downstairs. There was a heap of debris at the bottom of the stairs, and his father ran up to him in alarm. To his surprise, he found the child quite unhurt. "It is all right," the little one said. "Baba held me up." These are old tales. Those one hears today are mostly from devotees who were born since 1918. But they are no less vivid, and the help given is no less potent. None could be more categorical about this than Sai Baba. Quote, "I shall remain active and vigorous even after leaving this earthly body. My shrine will bless my devotees and fulfill their needs. My relics will speak from the tomb. I'm ever living to help those who come to me and surrender and seek refuge in me. If you cast your burden on me, I will bear it. If you seek my help and guidance, I will immediately give it to you." He said, there shall be no want in the house of my devotee. It is because his succor had been found so prompt and potent that he has such vast numbers of devotees, now as in his lifetime. But it is good to remember also that other saying of his, I will give people what they want in the hope that they will begin to want what I want to give them. That's the end.
Like Bhagavan said, when people say I'm going away, where can I go? I'm here.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that.
You know, like Bhagavan had a devotee, Kirapati, who used to make him spiritual. Same way he had one, Radha Krishna Mai, she used to make eggplant and give.
Was he a born Hindu or his?
I think he was born a Muslim.
He was born a Muslim.
Okay. Yeah. So, but we don't know. It is just speculation.
But he had a Hindu guru.
Yeah.
He had a Hindu guru. Yeah. And then on his journey, you said he went, he went to Muslim practice and Christianity.
He was probably born in a Muslim family.
Yeah.
But he had a Hindu guru. And very young age, he became.
We don't know where he came from. The name itself, you know, like Yasai, one of the. A horse carriage guy said, yes, I means, come on, mister. They used to give free rides in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So he became Sai Baba when they come.
Mm-hmm. And they don't know who that guru is either.
No, we don't know.
He never said. It may have even been another life or something. You know, this guy was
referring to his guru from the previous life.
Yeah.
What? Because he was young when he came there. He was young.
What is the plan tomorrow?
So I know one car going with Gita, Asha, Achu, and Arpan, and I'm going in one car.
Okay.
There's five in that car.
Anybody who wants to come back after can come in my car because I can't come to Aparna's house.
You can't come up.
No, I can't. I already committed to somebody.
All right.
But Aruna, I'm coming. Aruna is clashing with, you know, that Murli who comes here, Gayatri, but Aruna's I knew before, so I came with him there.
Okay. So you'll come back? Just come
after
back?
After the satsang, I'll come back. So anyway, we can take more devotees who want to come.
On Saturday?
Yeah.
So you'll go and come back the same day?
Yeah.
Oh. Alright. So it's Saturday.
Yeah, yesterday Tony texted me saying that she already, but I don't want to this thing.
Yeah, so all right.
So Tony's car also might be going, right?
She might, she doesn't know.
I
don't know. All right.
Yeah, a lot of people can come.
Who want to come back can come. There may be others. There's this one lady coming tonight, Benita.
Uh-huh.
From Florida.
Okay.
She said, I may go tomorrow. You know, she may want to go and come back.
Yeah. What about Monica and Co?
Yeah, we can call. I'll find out.
Monica. Anybody else? So when are we starting from here?
Well, I was thinking 6 o'clock.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like this time.
Yeah, no problem. You're staying back there?
Yeah, I'll stay back. And then Sunday go to Upper.
Yeah, it's not worth coming and going back there.
Are you driving?
Yeah.
She has a big car. You know her car, right?
No.
Oh, no. It's a pilgrim's van.
Yeah, my son said, take all your friends there.
Well, her son bought him the car so she can take the devotees around.
That's nice.
Yeah.
The devotee mobile.
Yeah, it is ashram car.
Like the Pope mobile.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad to be to have a little knowledge of Shirdi Sai Baba.
Yeah, Shirdi Sai Baba, yeah.
I'll start to
Mahatma. Read.